Warm up.
Yeah.
Have you ever sat in front of a like microphone like that?
No. Also, it's so fluffy. I really wasn't expecting that.
A warm welcome to our podcast, Identity Echoes, and our first episode ever. How exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time to sit in front of this microphone and record for my very first time. I'm extremely happy that you have tuned in, and just as much as you, I can't wait to dive more into today's topic. My name is Jasmin, and I am a social worker from Germany, currently living in Copenhagen, where I just completed my master's in migration studies. I'll be the host of this episode, and with me today is my former classmate Anu, who will be our guest for today. Welcome, Anu.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here for your first episode.
Nice to have you here. But before we get started, let me just quickly introduce you to our podcast, a pilot project born out of an Erasmus Plus training on diversity and inclusion. Identity Echoes. Who we are shapes the experiences we make and how these experiences translate into our mental well-being. With this podcast, we want to shed a light on the complexity of this echo by unraveling societal power dynamics and identity-related challenges. For each episode, we have invited a guest to share their personal story with us. This might be through a poem, a song, storytelling, or any other form of personal expression. Subsequently, we will get into a dialogue with our guests to gain a better understanding of the forms of identity-related mental health challenges that we talk about. The podcast will deliberately start with the individual's contribution before providing any further information about the guest and the topic. The aim is to sharpen our ability to listen, to reflect, and to empathize with our guests' personal experiences and the way that they express them. This podcast is meant to create a safe space where the invited people can freely express themselves, their experiences, and their emotions without any fear of judgment. For some of you, the stories might provide perspectives that you have not been aware of before. For others, we really hope that this format can help you see that you are not alone with the challenges you're facing, and that people are willing to listen to your experiences. Last but not least, I want to highlight that this podcast condemns any form of discrimination based on identity markers such as gender, origin, ethnicity, religion, and others. I think I've talked enough for now, and I'm so excited to finally give the stage to Anu. It's time for your stories, and all eyes are on you.
When I was 6 years old, my paternal grandparents came to visit us in New York for the first and last time. I can't remember much about their time with us, but I remember their arrival and their departure. I remember the jittery excitement I felt that day in school. It was a Friday in October. We ended the day with drawing, and I made a poster to welcome Nanima and Thothia. On it, in big pink bubble letters, "Welcome back to America," and underneath was a stick figure drawing of the seven of us, my parents, my brothers, my grandparents, and me, holding hands. When I got off the school bus, I excitedly ran into my house and showed my parents the poster. Nana shook his head, and he told me that this was my grandparents' first time in the U.S., and even though I was American, they were not. When we drove to JFK, I left my poster at home in my room and under my bed. I don't know how I expected to feel when Nanima passed away. Her death wasn't unexpected. She was severely ill with limited lung capacity for more than 3 years. Nana was taking more and more trips back to India from New York to spend time with her. But I guess knowing that a death will come soon can only help so much when you get the news that it has happened. When I learn that Nanima has passed away, my stomach is in knots. I start to cry almost instantly. I feel like the walls are closing in on me and I'm about to hyperventilate. I need fresh air. I think of the advice about how to process a loved one's death, to recount your favorite memories with them, to try to incorporate some of their favorite things, foods, hobbies, scents, into your life to help you feel their presence, to take solace in the fact that for the rest of your life that your loved one will still be with you because you'll always have these memories, and each time you see one of their favorite things, you'll spontaneously remember them. Except, I can't do this for Nanima. I can't recollect any shared memories. I don't know what her favorite things are. I realize again that I don't know her. Does not knowing her guarantee that I will forget her? That I will never think of her again? Does this make my already tenuous relationship to India, which I feel like is already withering away, even less existent. This isn't the first time a family member in India has passed away. I was 16 when my Thathia passed away after a long battle with Parkinson's, but it didn't fill me with the same existential and emotional intensity that Nanima's passing has. Maybe that's because of the decades that separate the two deaths. Time that has been filled with my ongoing reflections of what it means to be the daughter of a diaspora and simultaneously have more opportunities and resources than any other woman in my lineage while paying an ironic tax. We're taking advantage of such riches, the new opportunities that no other woman in my family has had only distances me from the very people who fought so hard to give me them. Or maybe Nanima's death hit me differently because Nana has told me ever since I was a little girl that I remind him of his Amma, with my seemingly calm demeanor that is underridden with a stubborn determination, and the width that graces the end of my nose and the angle at which it curves. I desperately try again to search my mind for memories of my Nanima, but it feels like trying to cup water with open hands and with fingers far apart. I mean memories like real memories, like the ones American kids have with their grandparents on TV, or ones that I imagined my childhood school friends having with their frequent weekend trips to grandma's house. A memory beyond the flurry of Zoom and phone calls we had that just followed a set script in my American-accented Telugu. The same script as two complete strangers crossing paths in New York, where "How are you?" is a greeting and reply all in one. I haven't been to India in a decade. It's a month after Nanima's passing. I'm in New York in my childhood bedroom. Nana gives me the ring that Nanima wore every day for as long as he can remember. I somehow recognize it right away. He puts it on my finger and tells me the ways in which I remind him of his beloved Amma, and though I've heard this spiel countless times before, I relish in it. A memory comes back to me almost crystal clear. Nanima's departure after her first and last trip to New York. We shared our tearful goodbyes at Terminal 5 at the JFK airport. Nanima and Thathia must continue on without us to the security line. There is a clear, flimsy wall separating us, so my parents and I start trying to catch final glimpses of them in New York. Nanima looks at me and places her hands on the wall, and I put my small hands up against it too. We both stay that way until the last possible moment when the TSA agent yells for her to move forward.
Anu, thank you so much for your story. I really loved how your text so authentically displays your thoughts and experiences as a child. I know that creative writing is a way for you to engage with your identity, and I also know that you've already performed on multiple times at open mics and published your text and scenes. Maybe could you quickly give us a background about the context you wrote this text for originally and how you got engaging with this memory?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that question. So I think, like you were saying, I've always really engaged with the world through creative writing. And a big part of that for me is that growing up in, like the early 2000s in the US, I just felt that experiences like mine as like the daughter of Indian immigrants in a predominantly like white suburb in Long Island, New York, that I felt like very alone in what I was experiencing. But I love to read, and I wanted to read stories like mine. So if I could write my own stories, it made me feel more seen. And also, even though I wasn't the only one having those experiences, it really felt that way at times. And yeah, that's just a technique of coping with my life and the world around me that stuck with me ever since I was very small. And yeah. And then as an adult now, I really love to share my work, even if it is very vulnerable, like what I shared earlier at different open mics. So the piece that I read at the beginning, I also read at a local open mic in Copenhagen. That's all about centering BIPOC voices in Copenhagen. And I think it's quite unique in that regard. And I also use this piece as material for my master's thesis, in which I leveraged autoethnography, and for that I like just took different pieces of writing that I had already written and journaled about, and analyzed them for my thesis.
Well, and thank you so much for sharing that text with you as well, with us as well. I'm a bit nervous for my first time of recording. Yes, but we really appreciate you sharing this text with us. And I think we've gotten already a little bit of an insight about you from the text that you've read for us. But I'm also sure that our audience would love to know more about your person, Anu. Your text tells us about your childhood perspective growing up in the US with your grandparents living very far away in India. Right now, we're sitting here in Copenhagen, where you're currently living. Maybe could you give us a bit more of a background about you and your migration experience?
Yeah, for sure. So I was actually born in Hyderabad, which is a capital city in South India. And we migrated to the US when I was just a few months old. And we moved because my dad had the opportunity to transfer to the New York office with his company. And it wasn't like a big aspiration for my parents to migrate to the US. But it just sort of happened. And when we migrated, it wasn't going to be a long-term thing, but it just sort of happened as that stuff can tend to go. And yeah, so like we migrated to New York right away, to Long Island, New York. And I remember we moved first to this like small townhouse in a suburb called Mineola. And then when I was 4, we moved to the house that I then lived for like 14 years straight, my childhood home in Jericho, New York, also in Long Island. And then after that, I went to college in North Carolina for 4 years after turning 18. And then, lived in Boston for a few years. And then I moved to Copenhagen. And I moved to Copenhagen because, during my university bachelor days, I did a semester abroad in Copenhagen because I was campaigning, I had campaigned for Bernie Sanders during the Democratic primary. And he was always talking about how the Danish welfare state was just like really great. And being an American who in the US, we don't have any sort of like social welfare system whatsoever, like universal healthcare is still seen as this very extreme socialist idea. Like the Danish welfare system just seems so interesting and unique to me. So yeah, I just wanted to see what Copenhagen was like in reality. And I then met my boyfriend 2017. And we, have been together. And then I wanted to move back to Copenhagen to be closer to him and then also to pursue my master's in migration studies, which is of course how I met you. So yeah.
That's really nice that we met each other. Thank you so much for this introduction, Anu. It's really interesting to get a bit more of a background about you. Connecting the text that you've read to what you've described now about your personal life journey, I think that the topic of family and diaspora becomes particularly interesting. With your migration experience, physical distance to family and loved ones as well becomes kind of an inevitable companion. So on the one hand, there's your family back in India where you were born. On the other hand, your parents in the States where you grow up. And there's also your Danish partner, who was a huge factor, as you describe, for your choice to permanently migrate to Denmark. Given the challenges that you describe related to growing up in physical distance from your grandparents, how did you feel when making the decision to move close to your boyfriend, which also meant creating physical distance to your parents in the US?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, actually, because I think something that can be hard for people to understand if you haven't experienced what it's like to have your identity split between three different continents at this point, like North America, Europe, and Asia, is the reality of having a lot of different places that feel like home or that you can be comfortable with and identify with, but not feeling completely rooted anywhere. Something that I think is relatively unique about my family situation, even compared to other Indian American families with people who migrated to the US from India around the same time my parents did, which was in the mid-90s, is that my parents were the only ones on each side of their families to migrate to the States. And so for me, that meant like growing up in the US and knowing I had like a huge family in India, but like not experiencing that, like how I described in my piece. And then also even still, like, I think I sometimes felt like I was really on the outskirts of American society and culture, despite maybe if you looked at me from like an outside perspective, thinking that I was like fully integrated in American society, because I, did really well in school and was on sport, like a sports team, and just like had friends who were,
mixed races and everything, so it was like a diverse friend group. And so I think it seemed like I really fit in, and I did in a lot of ways, which I'm very thankful for. But at the same time, like, I just never felt that rooted in the U.S. at the same time because of not having a ton of family and, like, not necessarily feeling super connected or not feeling like I truly belonged in the U.S., which I think is, of course, like, a sad thing to experience. But at the same time, I think it meant that, like, moving to Copenhagen didn't feel like such a big deal. Also, in terms of my parents as well, I think this is a really common experience for the children of immigrants. But growing up, my parents and I definitely fought a lot about what it meant to be like a good daughter or to be a good person, because my perspective was very shaped by, yeah, growing up in New York and what I saw everyone around me doing and how I saw people dating and just being able to go out with their friends and be very social. And that's not what my parents wanted from me. So I think in that sense, it was very much so like a cultural hybridity clash between us. So I felt like some distance would actually be quite nice in a way to give me space to just explore my identity without feeling like I always had to answer to someone who had a very different cultural understanding of what's morally good and what's morally not okay.
Yeah, that's a very interesting aspect that I also haven't thought about that much before. Anu, as you already mentioned, and I also know because we studied together, as we mentioned multiple times.
it was great.
Yeah, it was really a nice time. You've written your thesis on kinship in the context of the Indian diaspora in the United States, with a particular focus on Indian American women's experience on kinwork and relatedness. Mm-hmm. I know as well that you've usually focused a lot on topics such as hybridity and racialization, both in your academic journey, but also in your writing. Can I ask you why you chose to conduct your thesis research around concepts of family and diaspora? And maybe if you want, you can give us a little insight into the perspectives you were engaging with.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, when I first started writing my thesis, I really, really wanted to focus on hybridity, and because I just think hybridity is such an interesting concept. But I think, I thought that family would be maybe a chapter of my thesis rather than being the central concept that ended up becoming. But as I was doing my research, I think I realized that like a big hole in my mind in hybridity theory is that it's so focused on the country of like ethnic origin and the country of migration, like where you actually migrated to. And I think it's really missing like a key modulator there for many children of immigrants, which is family. Because I think for me, at least, like my perception of Indian culture, it wasn't shaped by what was happening in India. It was shaped by how my parents explained Indian culture to me and how they enforced it, and by the like diaspora communities that they expected me to engage with. So like, I'm Telugu, and there was a Telugu Literary and Cultural Association for the New York area, and we went to events there. And then like I would go with my family, and then there would be other Indian families, and that was how I perceived Indian culture. So I think in that sense, that's a big hole in hybridity theory. And I felt that by centering my thesis on that, I would be missing out on a lot of these other dynamics that actually shaped mine and my co-researchers' experiences in terms of our lives in the States, where family was much more of a modulating factor than anything else. And then also like our role in our families. So I focused, like you said, my thesis on women and specifically looking at the role that daughters play in their family units.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you also for choosing specifically this text, as I think it is a topic that maybe not touched upon that much, but that many people or many of our listeners also might relate to. So thank you so much that we can address that topic. Getting back to your text, actually, it touched a lot upon the psychological distress that people with migration background can or might experience due to the lack of memories with family members, such as in your case, as you describe your grandma. Are there any insights that you can provide from your thesis about the ways in which people can navigate that challenge?
Yeah, so one of the main concepts I worked with in my thesis was this idea of relatedness, which is an idea that was coined by Janet Karsten, who's an anthropologist who basically was saying that family isn't something static, family is something that's actively done. And a material that you can see a sort of underwriting relatedness is kinship substances. And usually that's something that would be something biological. So, for example, like blood would be an obvious one, right? Which doesn't sound very nice, but yeah, you know what I'm trying to say. And of course, I think if you look at the piece that I wrote, what I perceived as being a substance of kinship in this American context are shared memories with your grandparents, like weekend trips to grandma's house. Mm-hmm. Like that was like a really common thing I saw with my friends growing up in school as a little girl. And for me, like I said, like I didn't have those shared memories. And so in that sense, I felt like I was missing out on like a key substance of kinship, right? So like, of course, I'm related to my grandmother by blood, but if you asked me what her favorite smell is, I wouldn't be able to tell you what it is. And that was something, like I said, that I really mourned with the loss of her, because it made me think that like I wouldn't be able to spontaneously remember her. And that really like frightened me, like as an adult, like just, or like a young adult who's becoming an older and older adult, right? Like I think it's common in your mid-20s to feel existential about getting older and becoming like the older generation in your family, right? To put it a bit grimly. And so that's why it was such a big deal for me then to inherit this ring from my grandmother that my dad gave me, because it just helped me see that like if I'm wearing this ring, maybe I don't have the same memories of my grandmother that a lot of my friends who I grew up with do. But by wearing it and taking care of the ring, it kind of serves as something I call in my thesis as like a surrogate substance of kinship. And it's something that I wear every day. I'm wearing the ring right now. And if I don't wear it, I like don't feel fully clothed. Like it just, like I've just gotten so used to always wearing it. And so by taking care of it, by wearing it, it just helps me make sure that like I'll always remember my grandmother. And in general, in Indian culture, like even apart from the diaspora, like the transfer of gold between generations, between women, is just like really, really important. So I just thought that was a really interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. I think it's like such a precious way of like active kin work, even though you might not be physically close to certain family members. Yeah, as you said, you're wearing the ring now. If you want, like, you can just describe a little bit how it looks, because I can see it, but our audience unfortunately can't see it. It's very beautiful, actually.
Oh, thank you. So it's, yeah, like there's a gold band, and then in the center, it's like a flower, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And the flower is filled with these like small white stones. They're white.
Yeah, I would say. So, like, yeah,
they're not very, they're shiny.
Very shiny. But it's very pretty. And generally, your jewelry is very, very pretty. I wish that people could see it.
Yeah, it's like all of the jewelry I wear like every day. Like I really love wearing jewelry, but I don't mix it up because it's like all jewelry that was gifted to me by different female family members from the generations above me. So I'm also wearing this like gold chain with an Om sign. And then in the inside, there's like a Ganesha head. And Ganesha is a Hindu elephant god. He's supposed to be like the remover of obstacles, and that was given to me by one of my aunts when I was 8 years old. And I have gone through periods of wearing it every day and not wearing it, but I've worn it every day for the past like 3 years or so. It's like something I started wearing after I moved to Copenhagen, actually. Yeah. Again, and then I'm also wearing this other chain that was gifted to me by my maternal grandmother. And then I have another ring that I also wear every day that was given from my maternal grandmother to my mom to me before I moved to Copenhagen. So, yeah, my jewelry means a lot.
Like, it's such a long, long journey as well for the ring, and like that you've been wearing it for so many years. It's really, really precious. You've previously talked about the method of autoethnography. Oh, it's so hard to pronounce when you're not like a native speaker. It's autoethnography.
That was great.
Yay, good job. maybe it would be good for our audience to, like, if you just gave a quick explanation of what that term means and why you choose to write an autoethnographic paper.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll manage by the end of the day.
No, it is a very hard word to say, even as a native English speaker. It's like the T and the Th sound so close to each other is tough. But yeah, so I think something that was really important to me with writing my thesis was that, of course, I had my core research question, which is about how Indian American women experience their like nuclear diaspora family units. But also something that was equally important to me for me to feel like I did my thesis justice and did well was pushing to say that we have to make room for vulnerability. And by that, I meant like leveraging just like raw, authentic experiences that people who are of migrant descent experience and centering their views and perspectives. Because I don't know how you felt like studying our master's degree. Like overall, I really enjoyed it. But I felt like in our methodology course, even though we discussed this idea of positionality and the idea that you could be an insider positionality, meaning that you are of the demographic group that you're studying in some way, I don't think we really did much to understand how that shapes the research methods that you use. And the demographics of our master's cohort was quite white and European, I would say. So I was one of the only like people of color in our cohort, and also I think the only person who was a person of color and came from like an immigrant background, like in terms of, I guess we were a lot of international students, but mm-hmm. You know what I mean when I say that.
Yeah,
in terms of being Indian American. And I think I just felt really frustrated during a big part of the thesis because I felt like to do well in the, or not the thesis, in the master's, because I felt like to do well in the master's, I had to take on like the role of like a white European person and always trying to be a bit of an outsider. And I wasn't really given the tools to leverage my own experiences, which are actually what inspired me to study migration studies in the first place, was my experience being the daughter of immigrants and like navigating these like interesting, tense and kind of dark, like hybrid cultural situations in my family unit. Mm-hmm. And so autoethnography to me was a way to use those experiences and leverage them and center them and, you know, kind of push my supervisor and my external examiner to see that by letting someone use those experiences, you can still get to these really interesting and rich, nuanced cultural insights. And it's something that I really hope migration studies can make more of a push for, because I think Sarah Ahmed explains this really well, where she says that for her as well, like there were times where she felt like a space invader in the academy because someone like her or me is someone who's like meant to be the field and not the researcher. And I think that really is a big loss for the field of migration mm-hmm. studies or similar fields to put people who have a lifetime of experiences in those topics and not put them at the center of people who are generating the knowledge and just having them be subjects. So that's why I chose to center autoethnography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is quite different from my position as a white European woman, but I definitely agree that it's so valuable to use your own positionality, especially with a migration background. And I think what is interesting about, like, I mean, our studies were mainly anthropology, and I think what is interesting about it that it centers human experiences, but yet there is always like this assumption that the researcher is kind of in this top position of a neutral outsider, like casting a light on certain experiences. But the way that your own experiences come in are like so valuable, as you say. So I really resonate with that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for these valuable thoughts, Anu. And I think before we approach the end of today's episode, I just wanted to ask you if there's anything left that you would like to tell the audience, like either those who can relate to your experience or like those who might not have engaged with the topic before.
Yeah, I think I'd just like to say that if you are someone who also is studying something kind of similar, like where you share a background with the nature of what you're studying, like with my case, with being an immigrant who is studying migration studies, that you can take with you that it's so valuable to have you in those rooms, even if they don't feel like they're crafted and made for you, that you
are very, very worthy of being there. And I hope that this can, help shed some light on that in general to people who maybe don't have those same demographics to take those people's personal experiences very seriously and see how they can push you further than rather maybe making you be on the defensive. And I think a really great resource if you also struggle with mental health as it relates to your immigration experiences is an Instagram page called Brown Girl Therapy. It's run by an Indian American woman who is also a therapist, and it's just really, really great for looking at this intersection.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Anna. I think that was like such a perfect ending, and thanks as well for providing that resource. I will definitely check out the Instagram account, and I will also put it in our episode description. We've approached the end of this podcast, and I'm so excited to have done this with you, and it like felt so natural. I think like recording for the first time is like such a new experience, but at some point you just totally forget that you're talking in front of a microphone, and it just felt like such a natural conversation. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much for having me. And it was also my first time being on a podcast as well. So
which you could definitely not hear. you're such a natural talker. Like it's really, really inspiring.
It's the American in me that makes me good at talking, I guess.
Well, dear audience, we hope that you enjoyed today's episode with Anu on Family and Diaspora. And I hope that you have become interested in joining us again next time. I also want to encourage you to maybe just go back to the beginning and listen to Anu's text again. Now that you've engaged more with the issue that she touched upon, you can also find the text in the episode description. My name is Yasmin, and this was Identity Echoes, a collaborative effort born from an Erasmus Plus project involving youth workers from different countries in Europe. We thank you so much for listening to us, and we hope that through the contributions and dialogues, we can all together learn how to stay aware of and empathize with the people in our surroundings. Take care and goodbye.